You're listening to
Maine and Gray, the intersection of the city of God with the city of man, where we talk with interesting people doing interesting things out in God's world, and all for God's glory.
Since there are cameras, thank you for not wearing your swimsuit today.
Yeah, absolutely. That would not be good.
No, no swimsuits allowed on the Maine and Gray show. So, but thank you for being here, Joe Keller, coach of lots of swimmers, but Fishers High School.
Correct.
Is your main play. Do you coach?
That's the hub.
That's the hub.
Yeah, and then I coach Fishers Area Swimming Tigers, which is
okay.
kind of the feeder program, if you will, for the high school.
Mm-hmm.
But we have a lot of athletes that are, they don't necessarily go to Fishers High School, but okay. reside in the district or even out of district that come to our club. So okay. a little expansion yeah. of what we work with at the high school level.
Yeah, but it is a good feeder mm-hmm. program for the high school.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I also serve as the aquatic facility coordinator.
Okay.
At Fishers High School.
And okay.
so
what does that entail?
So that entails scheduling mm-hmm. and making sure that all programming is operating as it should, yeah. lifeguards, I mean, all those kind of details. And so, yeah, and even like from a pay standpoint, if you will, then the high school position with the aquatic facility coordinator position is about 17% of my job. Responsibility.
Oh, wow.
The club is the other 83%.
Oh, wow. That's a lot.
Yeah. So it's really very different because when I was up north, I was immersed in public education mm-hmm. and part-time teaching, even though it was a full-time job,
mm-hmm.
but it was still part-time in the classroom. And the rest of my time was spent in aquatics.
Oh, wow.
And then I did other things too. Like I wrote the bylaws for facility usage mm-hmm. by community and rentals, and then I had to manage those things.
Administrivia.
Yeah, I do a lot of administrivia.
Yeah, really. Yeah.
A lot. So, but yeah, but really my primary focus here is on coaching. And when I was up north, that was one of the reasons it was a big pull to come here.
Uh-huh.
The resources, the opportunities, and really to the true passion that I have, and that is coaching and working with athletes.
Yeah.
And why I love teaching, it's just different in a classroom situation
sure.
because the general population, some people don't want to be there
right.
at times. And so it's just really, really nice to sync up and line up my passion mm-hmm. with others' passion.
Yeah, and that's a blessing. What a gift from God.
It is. It's really awesome. Yeah, absolutely.
Awesome. So you said up north. I guess I don't know that part of your story. Where up?
Yeah.
What do you mean by up north?
So I coached and taught at Northridge High School for 26 years. It's in Middlebury, Indiana.
Okay.
And if people haven't heard of Middlebury, then what I always follow up with is it's near Shipshawana. So most people know where Shipshawana is.
I actually have heard of Shipshawana.
Okay, yeah.
A lot of Amish people.
Yes.
Kind of towns there.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. So it's about 35 minutes just directly east of South Bend.
Okay.
And so when I graduated college, went there, and I spent 26 years there.
Teaching?
PE.
Okay, yeah.
Yep, PE, and then aquatics,
mm-hmm.
and never imagined ever leaving there.
Yeah.
At a certain point, I met Patty there.
Yeah.
We got married there.
Cool.
Church, and our boys grew up there and went to school, and we were immersed in the church that we attended there.
Right.
Patty's family lives there.
A big change then. It's a big city calling, right?
Yeah. So, but one thing led to another, and here we are in Fishers, and this is the start of year 8.
That's cool. But you get to do more coaching with
yes.
here, which is great because that's really what you love. How did you get into coaching? Like, what was that path like?
So I went to Ball State University
mm-hmm.
and I swam on the collegiate team there.
Yeah.
And through that, early on, I felt like I just early on, I had that kind of call and mm-hmm. passion to want to work with people. And so it was kind of a natural segue through public education and being a teacher. So got into teaching. And and then during that time frame I was there, I tried to learn as much as I could about coaching. Actually took a course in coaching. And then one of our former Olympic coaches in diving was actually the diving coach there. And so so I hung out with him quite often and just tried to pick up what I could. And
but you weren't a diver.
I was not a diver, just a swimmer.
You were the back and forth guy.
Yeah, the back and forth, stare at the black line on the
stare at the black line.
Yeah.
You got one job, stare at the black
exactly.
line. What was, did you have a particular swimming, and I'm so ignorant in this,
yeah,
but like
it's
a,
okay.
freestyle.
Breaststroke.
Breaststroke.
Yeah,
okay.
That was my, that was kind of my forte. Yeah, and so, yeah, so it was really just something I knew from the mm-hmm. beginning when I went to school, what I wanted to do, and then as soon as I got out, it was try to find a job where I could do that, and actually the week before I graduated from Ball State, I had found on the, at that time, I'm old enough to where, like, it wasn't like you go on the computer, right?
Yeah, it was open to classifieds. Like, is it, are we talking that old?
No, it was one of those things where we had like this online phone service, job service that at school, and it would post jobs, and so I would call into it, dial into it.
Oh, interesting.
And listen to all the jobs. Yeah. And listen to them, and then it, they'd scroll through, and so yeah, so I came across one. And. And then I reached out, and the week before I graduated, I actually took the job at Northridge High School. So,
that's cool.
Yeah.
Did you have any coaches like in your past that were like that were meaningful to you, and you think like maybe that kind of got you into interested in coaching? Like, oh, coaches are very important.
Yeah, I don't think it was so much coaches got me interested mm-hmm. in it as it was just my passion for the sport and the activity and
okay.
the people.
Yeah.
And but yes, coaches that I had were very instrumental, and mm-hmm. and you know, much like many of us in our youth, you know, we've got people that help guide and direct us and help us to kind of find, you know, our way and where we're headed. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think every coach that I had was a contributor, mm-hmm. and still today I still draw upon some aspect of that from every single coach that
yeah.
I worked with.
Yeah. That's cool. Mm-hmm. I know for me, I've done some coaching. Soccer was my sport, and
yeah.
I love the game. And coach at the college level and like high school level as well. And I found I wasn't the best athlete. I'm just not. I don't have the body for it. I'm short. I'm stocky. You know, whatever. Mm-hmm. But I found that I was a better coach than I was an athlete. Do you find that to be true? I'm not saying you are, but is that often the case that sometimes, you know,
yeah.
coaches are better coaching than they were actually?
Absolutely.
In the sport.
Yeah, and that's the same for myself. I mean, I was fortunate enough to be able to swim at the Division I level, but never qualified
yeah,
for an NCAA meet, anything
uh-huh.
like that. So that was a little above my level,
mm-hmm.
but certainly I think I find that coaching is something totally different.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really teaching
mm-hmm.
and, there's a lot of people that can do something, but they can't explain how to help someone else to do that.
Right.
And so it's a different skill set, and some people just don't really have much interest in that
yeah.
or the patience or whatever
right.
it might be.
Right.
But, yeah, for me, that was the light bulb, right? That was the thing that really, just kind of made me tick in a lot of ways
yeah.
As to what I love to do.
Yeah, there's a joke, and I hope this isn't offensive, but there's a joke. Those who can do,
exactly.
those who can't teach, those who can't teach, teach PE.
Exactly.
Have you heard that?
Yep. Yep.
I just thought that was funny, because I was a PE teacher too, so I don't take it personally.
No, I don't either.
Yeah.
And absolutely. Yeah, actually, it's kind of interesting because over the years of teaching, I would at times find things to be humorous in
yeah.
a classroom teacher. If a change happened, it was like it upset
right.
everything,
yeah.
right? Whereas in PE, especially in the fall or the spring, you're outdoors, it rains, you got to change on the fly, you got to be flexible.
Oh, yeah.
And so, yeah, different skill set, right?
Yeah, and no matter what, you're always the favorite teacher because you play dodgeball or something.
Yeah, they typically enjoy it.
Yeah, they typically enjoy it. So what do you find particularly rewarding about coaching? You know, is it just you just love doing it for the sake of it? Do you love seeing kids progress or helping kids? Like, what do you find to be a rewarding part of your job?
I think there's a really kind of a multitude of things with that. But ultimately, I think over my, now this is the 34th year of coaching, wow. I think, you know, there's some maturation that occurs over that time.
So. Yeah,
and,
I'm sure there has.
Yeah, and so I think the thing that has really come to be most important to me is really pretty simple. It's the relationships,
mm-hmm.
And that component of it. And I think that's what really drives a lot of the people that I work with as well.
You know, yeah.
They're looking for those types of relationships, and I think that's just really valuable,
mm-hmm.
and it's important. And mm-hmm. I think that's the thing that really just drives me the most. But yeah, seeing people improve, seeing people get better, reach goals.
Mm-hmm.
There's a multitude of things
yeah.
like that are really rewarding,
mm-hmm.
As a coach. But it's all tied to that personal component and the relationships and the basis of that.
Yeah. Nope, phone call. Maybe they want to be on the show too. If it's Patty, you can take it.
I apologize. I should have muted that.
No, it's fine.
That was actually the coach at the University of Florida who was one of our Olympic
coaches. Well,
if
you need to take it,
no,
we can pause.
It's okay.
If you're getting called up to the big leagues, I don't want it to stand in the way. That's funny. Yeah, so it is. I mean, coaching is very rewarding,
mm-hmm.
because you get to see kids develop or, you know, just take the next step,
mm-hmm.
Achieve a goal, celebrate the win.
Yeah.
You know, that's just so much fun.
Yeah, and I also think there's a huge responsibility in that, too,
mm-hmm.
that a lot of people maybe don't realize when they are get into coaching. Or maybe they do, but it kind of sits on the back burner. But I think the longevity in the nature of the sport that I coach and with the athletes that I coach has a different level of responsibility in how we work with kids as well. So as an example,
mm-hmm.
When I was at Northridge, we took the kids in the summer, got a chartered bus and went to Sandusky, Ohio to the park there, amusement park and all that. And so we had chaperones and had one of the guys, dad's was one of the chaperones, and he was kind of the owner of several of the RV, in the RV industry,
okay.
In some of that manufacturing
mm-hmm.
Business. And so we had this conversation, and this is like 20 plus years ago, and so it still resonates with me, but he said, you know, and he was really instrumental in a lot of nonprofit organizations and helping people and, you know, that type of thing. But he said that he was really envious of, you know, kind of my role, my position as mm-hmm. a coach. And I thought that was kind of intriguing because
yeah.
he drove cars that I don't think about driving and so on and so forth, right? You know, just very blessed in that way. And so so as I delved into that, then he kind of talked about the impact that you're able to have on people,
mm-hmm.
You know, and over time too, right? And so, because some of these athletes that I coach, they start in our program as young as 6
mm-hmm.
and through 18 years old. That's a substantial amount of time that you're spending with someone, and so the responsibility in that that you start to realize is how much modeling you're doing, and you
mm-hmm.
know, making sure that what they're seeing
mm-hmm.
is what that you hope that, you know, you're actually portraying as a person.
Yeah, and that is a long time. I mean, that's pretty cool that you can be a steady influence
right.
over, you know, a decade or more in a kid's life. And you know, you never know what social setting some kids come from, but some of them might not have much stability in their lives.
Yep.
And then, but God's put you in this place where, you know, for a decade or more, you're there, not changing, which is really, it is a big responsibility, but it's a huge privilege.
Absolutely.
To be a part of that.
Yeah, we actually, we work with another program from our program, with like dry land and this type of thing. And so the owner and founder of that actually lived in Miami. And
what, I back up, what is dry land?
So
I just assumed you meant like land.
Weight training.
Oh, okay.
Weight training. Yeah.
So like stuff.
Cardio components.
Workouts that apply to the pool.
Workouts.
It's not
in
the pool. Okay.
Exactly.
Brought me up to speed.
Yeah. And so this company is called Swim Strong Dry Land, and we partner with them. But the owner is from Miami. Well, it ends up that he just moved to Fisher or to Zionsville.
Okay.
And so he's working in our program. But make a long story short, there's an athlete who just moved from Miami to Fishers to train with us because of that connection that they had.
Yeah.
And now the connection that we're building, he was actually a freshman at the University of Texas last year, and it ended up that they had a coaching change, and he was one of several people that lost his opportunity, was cut from the team. And when that happens in April, May, and there's no other opportunities at that point, so he decided to take a year off from school. And after he kind of found the direction that he wanted to go, then with Eric, the owner and founder of Swim Strong, I met with them during the Olympic trials this summer, and, you know, could we create a situation where, you know, we could help him? So it ends up that he moved in the end of August here from Miami. Yeah, he's living in Fishers and he's training with us.
That's cool.
Yeah, so our sport kind of works that way a little bit, but it's the relationship component and helping people grow as people.
Yeah,
you know, is just as important as growing as an athlete.
Yeah, for sure.
And they go hand in hand.
Yeah, and you know, from a Christian perspective, God's doing all of these things, like He's
exactly
moving people where they need to be to develop and to change and possibly even be, you know, reached with the good news of Jesus, which is, that's cool that you're a part of that in a very real way over a long time in someone's life. That's awesome. So back up just a little bit. I want to know more about the coaching aspect. And again, forgive my ignorance, but are there seasons that you're coaching? Or is there a swim season? Because to me, it's indoors. You can do it year round, but I'm guessing there's a time that is, you know, you're going to meets and competitions and things
like
that.
We theoretically have what's called a short course season, which basically runs from 1st of September through basically into March. And then we have a long course season, which runs from basically the end of March all the way up through the end of August. So it's year round.
It is year round.
It's year round.
What's the difference between short course and long course?
So short course is like 25 yards. Whereas long course is 50 meters, like what you would see on the Olympics.
Okay, gotcha.
Right? Yeah. And so, but there are short course events that occur during the long course season and vice versa, but it's predominantly designed that way.
Okay, so just in general, you're always busy.
Always busy. It's a full-time job.
It is a full-time job.
Yeah.
Keeping kids coaching kids in the water.
Yeah, it's when I tell people when they ask, it was pretty easy to say, oh, I'm a teacher, right? Or a teacher coach.
Yeah.
But to say I'm a coach, they're like, okay, you make a living off of coaching? How does that work?
Yeah, and I think, I mean, probably, I'm guessing I'm not unlike most of our listeners where we just don't know
exactly
what the seasons are for, you know, if you ask me about basketball or soccer or something, I can give you an answer. But.
Sure. Yeah. So what we do through club swimming is way beyond rec league type work that you would do, or even like a summer league swim team, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, so as a head coach at Fast and Fishers, then we currently employ 5 other full-time staff. And then I employ, beyond that, 14 part-time coaches.
Big organization.
It is. And then we also own and operate our diving club and program. Mm-hmm. And so we've got 2 coaches there that we employ. And then we run swimming lessons, learn to swim program that mm-hmm. operates every month throughout the year, all 12 months. And we, this past year, put somewhere just over 1,200 children through lessons.
Oh, wow.
So I have a full-time staff member that manages that. And then monthly, we're working with somewhere just over 100 children. And that's typically in the PM, mm-hmm. in the summertime. Obviously, we have access to children at different times all day long, but not so during the school year.
Yeah.
So,
and my head's spinning just thinking about the, not just the coaching, but the, I mean, there's so many different domains because you have mm-hmm. some logistics for all of those things. It's just a lot to. I hope you have a few assistants.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you think about all of that happening in one space, then the, just the management of that space, there's a lot of coordination. So it's a lot more involved and engaged than what anyone would ever imagine.
Yeah.
And so it's everything from the Learn to Swim program, you know, just and kind of the introductory level.
And is that the one where they throw the babies in the water and just hope that they float?
Not quite so much.
Oh, okay. But, I feel like that's what I see videos of. Like,
I've heard that method.
Look, our baby's swimming. Like,
yeah.
I don't know that I'd do that.
Yeah, we've seen that method. But really, when I was up north, we started children at 6 months old.
Wow.
But here, we start them basically at 4 just because of the water depth mm-hmm. and the pool temperature. The 6 month to 3-4 year old, it's a little cold. Mm-hmm. So, but we're going to be expanding our programming into mm-hmm. another local facility where there's warm water opportunities. But again, it's just organizing all those things. Yeah. And then there's a lot of outreach type programming that we make available for people who, you know, can't maybe afford to learn mm-hmm. a life skill mm-hmm. in swimming.
Yeah.
So through the schools, et cetera. There's just all kinds of facets. And then to be able to manage a not-for-profit program like what we do, and to be totally transparent, nothing to hide here, but I operate a operating budget of right about $750,000.
Oh, wow.
Through our swim organization, which most people would be like, are you serious?
I know. It's water.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's just got so many different levels to it. Yeah. So things with marketing and sponsorships and fundraising and, you know, everything that you have to do to manage a not-for-profit program to keep things afloat, so to speak.
I know. I had heard from your family that you were busy. I didn't know the depths of your busyness. It's that's a lot of things you're managing.
Yeah, and the thing that becomes pretty trivial and becomes challenging is that during the school day, obviously we don't have access to coach kids at that time, mm-hmm. right? And so all of our time spent with athletes are either morning time mm-hmm. or their PM time.
Yeah.
And so coaching has some tough components to it.
It's not just rewarding. There's some difficult stuff.
There's some challenges mm-hmm. Just because people are making real sacrifices mm-hmm. in the PM, inclusive of family time mm-hmm. at times, that becomes really challenging. Mm-hmm. So Patty and I, my wife, you know, we've figured out how to make that work for 29 years.
Different rhythm,
It is. It's a very different rhythm. Yeah. But that's why a lot of people you know, choose not to do something like coach because of some of those restraints that it has on just life mm-hmm. in general and managing those things.
Yeah, that's pretty demanding. Wow. Mm-hmm. There's rewarding parts, difficult. How do you think being a Christian has helped you be a better coach? How has, you know, whether it's something you learn at church or just, you know, how you've grown as a Christian, you able to pass that on to to some of your athletes?
I think the simple answer would be in everything, in every way.
That's a good answer. Yeah, but a Christian answer, of course. It is.
But let's delve into that a little bit more.
Yeah,
I think that I even back to me coming to Fishers, it's just truly remarkable to me how things kind of played out. As I said earlier, I never imagined myself leaving, but here I am, right? And so even how this position became available, I mean it's pretty obvious to me that, you know, that it's just part of God's plan, and orchestrated, and you know, people follow through on those things, and here we are. So it's truly remarkable. So how it affects my coaching, I think it's in everything, in every way, because I don't think any of this is obviously by chance,
right.
Again, it's been orchestrated. And so how I coach and what I coach, and then the knowledge that I have, and those have all been blessings that have kind of been bestowed upon me to be able to do this.
Yeah.
So, I think just in a very general sense, it's had an impact in my coaching in that respect. But I think more so, the real impact is in that of relationships. And I think that's what, you know, we're kind of called to cultivate as well. As a Christian, right, a relationship, and that's really kind of the passion that I have in our sport as well, and how we help people come along and make progress and grow, not only as a sport but as people. So I think it has a huge impact in everything that I do.
Yeah, that's good. And I think that, you know, God's placed you there for a reason, and I think that whether or not you know, you're able to share Christian truth with someone,
right,
you're still helping to shape who these kids are. And you know, I would rather you be doing that than someone who didn't have a Christian framework, and etc. I mean, my point is that it's good for our society in general, it's good for communities, it's good for families, in my opinion, to have someone like yourself doing this, which is, again, it's a responsibility but a privilege that you're out there doing that.
And I guess I will say too that you know, sometimes I have these inner dialogues with, okay, I think in anything that we do, why am I here, what's my purpose, and so on and so forth, right? But I think over time that's become much more clear to me, but there are difficulties in that at times in my current role, because as we know, with public education, there are lines that are become challenges as we work with people, and so we find ways to circumvent that a little bit, if you will. So as an example, you know, while it may not be something where I am direct in bringing up a conversation about Christianity, you know, I can still bring about discussions of values.
Sure. Yeah.
You know,
that's fair.
Absolutely. Right.
Yeah.
And so even on our wall at our pool, we've got these banners, and it's our Tigers values.
Yeah.
And you know, one of those is integrity, right? And that's the I in Tigers is integrity. Yeah, right. And there's a lot of discussions that can evolve from that.
Right.
And then, you know, it opens up that opportunity if an athlete feels compelled and they want to ask more questions,
to do so.
Then discussions can kind of occur from there.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's you know, you're within the bounds of the law and you know, the constraints put on you by a system, and yet people are free to talk to you because you've been in their lives for a long time, and they value you, and when they have questions or difficulties, they can come to you. So I think that's
exactly
a, that's a great way to be involved in people's lives.
Yeah,
that's
cool. Absolutely. And I think
especially when tragedy hits, right? I remember a few years ago when there was a terrible car accident.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that, you know, you being there was a steady presence for people.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, and it just opens up a whole nother world of the sport, mm-hmm. if you will. But all that's based upon the relationships that you've developed over time to be able to do that.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's awesome. So talk to me about the Olympics. I mean, this is probably... Sure. You probably get asked this a lot, and whenever this episode comes out, it'll probably be a little bit removed from the Paris Olympics this last summer. So you were there, but back us up a little bit. You were involved in the trials, out in Colorado Springs at the training center. Like, talk us through some of that. It's really interesting.
Yeah. Wow. There's a lot here, but I think I'll start with this, and that is, for listeners, they may be like, but if I ever had the opportunity to be put in a position to coach an Olympian again, I'm not sure that I would want that opportunity.
Oh, wow. You're going to have to explain.
Yes.
Why.
So, I mean, it's everything that we kind of work for as coaches, right? Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, the difference between good and great is so marginal.
It's like a hundredth of a second.
It's unbelievable.
The fingernail's length.
It's hard for people to really even conceptualize it, because if you take a stopwatch and you click it as fast as you can with your thumb, then it's probably going to be something like 0.2. And the difference then between 0.01 being second in Olympic trials and being third, over especially people that have appropriated 4 years of their life to this achievement, is unreal. It's the magnitude of it.
The pressure.
Yeah, it's a lot. So, would I want to coach another Olympian? Of course I would. Would I do it? Obviously I would.
Yeah.
But is it something that I'm praying for? No.
Yeah.
It's not something I'm praying for.
Not the coach
for.
We deserve. It's the coach we need.
Yeah. So it's a lot, because the journey with Luke, I started coaching him from start to when he finished the Olympics was about 3.5 years. Mm-hmm. And so he's from Noblesville, in his freshman year felt that he needed to make a change in what he was doing in his training and those types of things. So I started working with him, and at that time he didn't have like a junior national cut, which is a time standard, which is kind of the first benchmark towards moving towards like a national level.
Okay.
Athletes that achieve that are kind of about approaching the top 5% of all the athletes in our sport.
Okay.
So high level, but the difference between that and being an Olympian is 10 times more of a difference. So, it's just a lot. Mm-hmm. So it ended up that, as we started through that process, I started noticing things about Luke and kind of his personal characteristics that started leading me to believe that he could be really good. Because, as I said, good to great is so marginal, and everybody has talent, but whether or not you can get that talent out of someone so they reach and maximize their full potential is a different art and skill.
Mm-hmm.
And so over about the last year, from June of like 23, we started to recognize that we were making some strides, and there was a meet down at the Natatorium in Indy. And at IUPUI, or whatever,
Natatorium,
whatever they call it.
Yeah, it's a building with a pool inside.
Correct. Okay. Yeah, it was a national level meet, and it was what was called a qualification meet.
Okay.
And so at that meet, he qualified for the world junior team, And so in September last year, he and I with USA Swimming traveled to and had a competition in Israel.
Oh, wow.
It was literally 2 weeks before the breakout happened there.
Oh, that's right. I remember you were over there. That's right. I had forgotten that.
That was quite a unique experience. And I've never been to a swim meet where they kind of walk you through the facility and they show you where the bomb shelter is.
Really?
Yeah, okay. It was that moment.
It got serious fast.
Yeah, it was real serious. Yeah. But we felt totally safe.
Yeah, sure.
Everything went great. And
How old was Luke at the time?
I got at that point, he was 17.
Okay, so he's a junior. Yeah. He was a junior.
He was, let's see, he would just started his senior year.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and then he turned 18 sometime. I think it was in January.
Okay.
So then... So that at that event, we realized that there might be a chance, okay. Right? And so through a lot of planning and kind of mapping everything out and what that journey could look like and meeting with him and his family and are we all on board with this?
This is a family commitment. I mean,
it's a huge commitment.
Time,
yeah.
Money, yeah. Travel.
So he swam the 800 meter freestyle. That was his best event. That's when he qualified for the Olympics in. And he swam the mile, the 1500 meter. He actually got out touched in that. He got third. Mm-hmm. So he didn't swim that in Paris. But but in the 800 meter freestyle then, at that event in Israel, he went into that as his best was 8 minutes.
Okay.
And there he went 7 minutes and 55 seconds. And we knew to make the Olympic team, it was probably gonna take something around 7 minutes and 48 seconds. And while 7 seconds doesn't sound like a long time, when you're swimming, it's not quite the same as it is running, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so...
Just to me, swimming is hard for me, so...
Yeah.
It feels like a long time when you're swimming for 7 minutes.
Yes, but the distance is pretty enormous because you're just not traveling at the same rate of speed as when you're running.
Of course, yeah.
So, but that 7:55 gave us this indication that perhaps. So we did all the planning, we got everybody on board, and we started through the process. And what that meant was...
Let me stop you a second. Getting through the process, that sounds huge. Like, did you know what it would take to get an athlete to the Olympics? I mean, or did you have to, like...
I thought I knew.
Read up on... Yeah, okay. Yeah. Say, like,
yeah.
You met with people, but, like...
Yeah.
You had to educate yourself, I'm guessing, to find out what it means, like, to get from A to B.
Yeah, and I think those skills and that knowledge was there, and you know, and being able to help other athletes to high level events in the past.
Okay.
So, but yeah, definitely the physiology, the training, recovery, all the components that you have to be able to control. And, you know, we're talking, this is a 17, 18 year old that's in high school, right?
And,
and you think about as a 17, 18-year-old male, thinking about that type of commitment and dedication is probably a lot for most anyone.
Yeah, sure.
But
he had the drive.
He had the drive, and he wanted to get better. And so as we kind of went through that process, and there were benchmarks that we recognized that we're making progress, and probably about a month out, that's when I...
month out from
the trials.
Okay.
So it ended up that because of his event, the 800 meter free, you normally swim that in a typical meet only once.
Mm-hmm.
But at the Olympic trials, you have to swim it twice. So you swim it, in this case, it was on a morning, the prelims, and then the next evening you come back and you swim it in finals. And so it's a qualification round, and then once you get into the top eight, whoever the top two are, advance.
Wow.
And
what do you do between those two? Like go home and nap?
It's
and
a lot.
Eat a lot of carbs or something?
There's a lot of components mentally to managing that type of thing.
Uh-huh.
But to back up, at the start of the Olympic trials, he swam the 400 meter freestyle as his first event, and we really swam it just to get into the meet, see where we were, mm-hmm. what adjustments we needed to make for
test the
2 days later.
Literally.
Exactly.
Okay.
And so he swam his prelims. And at the end of the prelims, he was seated first going into finals.
Wow.
And we planned for a lot. We planned for almost everything. We did not plan for that. And so
for first place.
We did not plan for first place. And so at that moment, I was like, oh no, we didn't plan for this. What are we going to do?
Right.
And so, being flexible, you figure it out, right? So he came back that evening in that final. And it ended up that he got fifth,
mm-hmm.
and went like 0.1 off what he had previously. It's just that a lot of experienced men mm-hmm. went faster. They didn't have to go as fast as they needed to in the preliminary. Mm-hmm. And so, but it was still enough for us to be like confident that, yeah, this is going to happen.
Yeah.
But a month out prior to that, because of the nature of those events, then he came in on a Friday morning, and we did a what we call a test set
mm-hmm.
to prepare for that. And then he came back on Saturday night at the time that he would be swimming that final
mm-hmm.
at like 7:30 p.m. So on a Saturday night mm-hmm. when typically I might be with my family,
yeah.
we're dedicating time
yeah.
to do this. And yeah. we did that three different times
yeah, wow.
over the course of the months prior.
Mm-hmm.
And at that particular time, then I called my assistant after that test set, and I said, yeah, I think he's going to make the team.
Wow.
So
that's cool.
Yeah.
So he made the team.
He made the team.
You have to go out to the Colorado Springs Training Center? Or?
So we had done all that prior.
Oh, okay. So he had already trained out there.
Yeah. He actually spent between January to the 1st of April, right around mid-April, I guess it was. He had spent about 36 days out at altitude
mm-hmm.
and at the training center.
Yeah.
And I was out there about 4 weeks of that time. And wow. yeah,
such
and
a commitment.
It's a huge commitment, right? And cost and all of these things. Mm-hmm. So, but one thing that was, again, you just kind of look at how things work out, mm-hmm. right? And so Luke, because of the trip to Israel, his mom went into the school at Noblesville and said, hey, he's going to miss this week. Mm-hmm. And then he's got a training trip. And they're like, no, that's not going to work. And they were like, well, what are we supposed to do? And
did she say, like, yeah, but Olympics?
yeah. And so they're like, well, he's not going to be able to, because of attendance, he's not going to be able to do school as normal school. And so mom was not very pleased about that, to say the least. And so he had to do this online option.
Okay.
And so, but again, it just kind of, you know, shows how God is in control mm-hmm. of all of those components, yeah. right? And I truly believe, had that not happened, that he wouldn't have made the Olympic team. Because, you know, we do a lot of early mornings,
mm-hmm.
do a lot of afternoon evenings, but we were able to modify his training plan to where he could come in like mid-morning, get more sleep. He could do school as and when he needed to. It just worked out.
Yeah. And you have a good mom in your corner too. Good coach and a good mom.
Yeah. And wow. so that all worked out beautifully. Yeah. And so that's how kind of how that worked. And then when he made the Olympic team, they're able to go home for a week and train, and then they have to report to the domestic training camp. Okay. So
where is that?
So that was in North Carolina.
Oh, okay.
And so
the whole world I know nothing about. Like, there's the Springs, and then there's North Carolina, and
yeah. So they have a facility down there that's indoor, outdoor, a couple of long course meter pools, and down kind of in that triangle area between Duke, North Carolina, North Carolina State,
yeah.
Is where that facility's at. But a lot of people think you make the Olympic team, you get on a plane, you go to Paris, you get done, you go home, not even close. So So his commitment was basically from July 1st until they came home, mm-hmm. and it was 6 weeks.
Yeah.
So, you know, here you've got a teenager, and he's making a 6-week commitment. Mm-hmm. Pretty phenomenal. Yeah. So I was able to go to the domestic camp, and mm-hmm. so he and I flew down. We were there for a week, and that was probably the highlight of my coaching career.
Really?
Absolutely. And so,
why so?
The whole Olympic team is there. It's just kind of pure because they're training.
That's true. It's not, they're not fighting.
You don't have the media, and you don't have all this competition stuff that's going, right? And other than in daily training stuff, but it's just the staff, the coaches of those athletes, and the athletes. So
that's cool.
Yeah. And so, we got there on a Sunday evening, went to practice on Monday morning, and they didn't have to report until Wednesday, but the head coach, the guy who tried to call earlier, Coach Anthony Nesty, he was the men's coach of the team, and it ended up that he had kind of requested if Luke could be there early.
Okay.
And Luke swims in college there now, so he's currently his coach.
Oh, cool.
And so I said, sure. And I felt that would probably be best in his training plan anyway. So on Monday, there was only like a half a dozen athletes there. Mm-hmm. And it was just so cool because you got to see like kind of this personal component of it, right? And without everybody being there.
Yeah.
So then on the second day, we go to practice, and Coach Nessie's going to be working with one athlete, and his assistant's going to be working with another athlete. And he said, hey, can you take that group over there? And I had one of those moments where it was like, okay, you know, you kind of swallow deep and be like, say again.
You want me to coach the national team here?
Yeah. So it ended up that that group was Luke. Uh-huh. And then Bobby Fink, who set the world record in the mile and was the only individual that won a gold medal on the men's team. And then Katie Ledecky.
Oh, wow.
Who is probably one of the greatest swimmers of all time.
One of the most decorated Olympians ever.
Yeah. Right? And so he asked me if I would run that training set. And that's when I had to take a breath.
Yeah.
And so I started over there, and I turned around and I walked back, and I was like, what do you want me to say to Katie? He goes, I don't know. You did a great job coaching him. Just coach her. And I was like, oh, my goodness. So I think the first time I said something to her in the workout, I was probably stuttering.
You signed my towel? Like what?
I mean, unbelievable, right?
Yeah.
But as amazing as she is as an athlete, she was equally amazing as a person. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she got out and it was like, thank you, coach. And I was like she's got to be talking to somebody else. Yeah, so,
talking to you.
Yeah, so it was by far the greatest experience of my coaching career.
Yeah.
That week was a true learning experience, mm-hmm. unlike any other.
Yeah.
It was phenomenal.
Yeah, and it does sound like when you actually get to the games in Paris, I'm sure that just even the logistics of where you have to be when and security and all of that, that would be very taxing compared to what that experience is, where it's almost the people and the purity of the sport just kind of there for a few weeks.
Yeah, and it's really, truly amazing. The things that you don't see that you find out that you know, you learn, and how people are still able to achieve. Yeah. So as an example, where they were located in the athlete village, the very first day to the pool was an hour and 15 minute bus ride.
Mm.
It was like 90 degrees, no air conditioning.
I read about that, yeah.
Yeah, it was brutal. And by the end, they got it down to like 25 minute kind of bus ride. But for athletes to be able to perform and expect to be able to perform at a level like that, just brutal. Mm-hmm. At the athlete village, the food they said was good, but there wasn't enough.
Oh, wow.
And so they ran out of food at times. And so, yeah, can you imagine?
French cuisine can't keep up, huh? They got to learn Americans' appetites. That's the
Yeah, can you imagine being an Olympian?
Enough croissant.
Yeah. and you're having to DoorDash.
Yeah. Like, I just, it blows my mind that that's what we had to deal with.
But they had to deal with some of those things. So, yeah.
So what was it like being there? I mean, part of the games, was, I'm sure it was exciting, but also stressful just watching the competitions.
Actually, it really wasn't stressful because I wasn't on the coaching staff.
Okay.
And so, you know, after they left North Carolina, then they were in, they flew to Croatia. Mm-hmm. Right there on the Adriatic Sea.
Beautiful.
Yep. And so they were there for a week and a half. They had some difficulties training because the pool was outdoors, and because of the heat, the water temp was like in the low 80s, which was really hot to train.
Bath water.
So it made some difficulties. But then when they left there, they flew to Paris a week and a half before the game started. But for me, when we got there, I was actually out in Irvine at a national meet.
Oh, okay.
When they were there. And so I flew from LA directly to Paris. And then I got there the night before he swam the next day.
Okay.
So so we didn't have a lot of conversation, things like that prior, just a little texting, but I wanted to give him his space and the coaches. And so we get to the stadium and we're, you know, we're getting our seats just like any other spectator. Yeah. And although I had a stopwatch in my pocket.
Now I'm sure you did.
So,
you're a good coach.
Yeah. And so, really, I was a spectator. Yeah. And so it was kind of surreal.
That's cool for him, though, that, I mean, you know, you've been his coach for a little while and you were just kind of a presence there for him, a steady influence. And you weren't yelling at him on the side of the sidelines. What do you say?
The side of the pool.
Side of the pool. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You could just be kind of just there for him. You didn't have to be his coach, which is cool.
Yeah. And really the rewarding component of that is how do you set up an athlete for success or a person for success so that they can take the ownership and a responsibility and be able to do that themselves.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But so a little unknown fact is that Luke was the first 18 and under male to make an Olympic team, a male Olympic team in the sport of swimming since the year 2000 when Michael Phelps did it.
Oh, wow. How about that?
So it's kind of a man's sport.
Big shoes to fill or flippers or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Something to fill.
Yeah. So that was kind of a big deal, and it's kind of changed his life.
That's pretty cool. Yeah. So he has hopes for, before we get to hopes there, he did well. His best, he finished, I forget.
He finished 15th.
Okay. Yeah, which is cool. So he hopes to do more Olympics, I'm guessing. Yeah. Is that on his horizon?
Yeah. And one thing some people don't know, especially outside the swim world, people in the swim world pretty much know this, but I didn't know this until after the event, but he got sick. And so the day right after he raced, he tested positive for COVID.
Oh, man.
So he actually had COVID. And so it doesn't work well with our sport because of breathing.
Breathing, yeah.
Yeah.
You kind of need to breathe.
Yeah, so it was difficult. It was his second best time ever. Yeah. And the time that he went at the Olympic Games still would have made the Olympic Games from the U.S., but it was just a little shy of what he really wanted to achieve.
Yeah.
So
still hungry for more.
Yeah. It definitely has laid that foundation for him. And of course, the Olympics are going to be in L.A. in 2028. Mm-hmm. And of course, the college coach wanted him to take a little time off. He came back from Paris, and I think 3 days later, he was at the pool.
Yeah.
And
probably what it takes.
Yeah, it does. And so he's already making preparations, and I think that there's a great opportunity for him to do some pretty cool special things in 4 years.
That's awesome. Yeah, cool. It's cool that you could be a part of that, of his story, in different ways, and just being part of his life.
Yeah.
That's got to be rewarding. Well, I don't know that this is just as important, but can you help me swim better? So I'm okay in the water. I love being in the ocean. I genuinely enjoy swimming, but the laps thing, I sink. I can't, I don't float. I've tried every position. The only way I can float is kind of face down like a manatee. Mm-hmm. Like, well, that doesn't last very long.
Yeah.
Any tips before we go?
Yeah, so the floating thing, I know you had said something about not float, being able to float, yeah, but everybody floats. It just depends on how deep you float.
Okay.
Your body will level off at some point.
That's a fair point.
But if you're 8 feet under the surface, it's a problem, right? And so, yeah, there's some components and things that we could do. Okay. But yeah, if you want to do that, I'm game.
Yeah,
I'll help you.
Might have to do that because
before you leave.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. It's just kind of an ongoing joke in our family. We'll go vacation somewhere and dad can't float, just kind of sink to the bottom of the pool. And
well, and if I'm out in Colorado Springs, then
yes,
I'll have a hard time getting you into the Olympic Training Center.
Yeah, I've toured it, but I probably can't swim it.
Probably can't swim in it.
Hook me up to that machine that's like, what is that, the weight machine where you're swimming, but you're like harnessed against something? What's that called? Does it have a name?
Yeah,
the
I
beast?
Don't know. Yeah, I don't think it has a name.
It's incredible. Like, but, I remember hearing, I guess, Michael Phelps broke that or something.
Yeah.
He was swimming up there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think I'll get that device.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of weight on that, so pretty incredible what some people can do.
Yeah,
but I can help you if you want to.
All right, yeah, I'll schedule it. I'll call your assistant and see if I can get in. Well, Joe, thanks for being here. This is awesome. I love what you're doing. Keep it up. You know, stay sane. It sounds like it's a crazy schedule, but being involved in Christian ministry, I'm glad that we can be here for you on a weekly basis, and you can come to church and kind of get refilled as you're sent out there to do big things in people's lives. So
I appreciate that, and it's kind of interesting how I can sit through a sermon, take my notes, and be like, okay, how can I apply this to what I'm doing in my profession on a daily basis.
That's good. Well, thanks for being here. Keep up the great work, and looking forward to hearing great things.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Main and Gray is brought to you by Christ Community Church of Carmel, Indiana, at the corner of Main Street and Gray Road. If you're looking for a church home or just visiting the Indianapolis area, stop in and say hi. We'd love to get to know you. Until then, God bless.